I'd like now to welcome Jeff West. He's a professor and former president of the Santa Fe Institute. He spent much of his career as a high-energy physicist, and we're here to talk about the film Particle Fever. That film is screening at the Lenzic on Tuesday, the 11th of February at 7 o'clock in the evening. It's part of the Science on Screen series, which is a collaboration among the Santa Fe Institute, the CCA, and the Lenzic. And director of the film, Mark Levinson, will be there along with Jeff West and Valerie Plame. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Pleasure to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a film about the Large Hadron Collider, and it was made by a physicist who turned into a filmmaker and made a film about this. And I think the collider is kind of a fascinating phenomenon in a number of ways. First of all, it's this big, sexy, massive thing that virtually nobody understands. What is it?
Well, yes, it's called a machine, but what it really is a very large ring, a circular ring, basically, around which protons, which are part of the nucleus of atoms, but we can strip them and they are then sent around the ring in one direction and then in another, and then they're in the opposite direction, and then they're brought together to collide. Then at the collision point, great big detectors are set up, enormous detectors are set up to look at the debris that comes out of this collision, these huge numbers of collisions that are taking place. And the physicists have made sufficiently sophisticated theories that have been tested and understood that they can use the detection of the debris that comes from the collision to look for new physical phenomena, new kinds of things that are either already predicted but haven't been seen, or even more hopefully, see things that are totally unexpected and indicate something that we don't know and yet to be explored. So in a way, I suppose it should be viewed a little bit like just a gigantic microscope in some way that we use to look at distances that are a tiny fraction of the nucleus of an atom. So they're extraordinarily small distances. And in order to get to those extraordinarily small distances, we need to have beams that are extremely high energy. So you can penetrate down to those distances.
And so what you have is basically a giant experiment used, as you say, to test theories. Those theories have to precede the design of the experiment and the devices in this place.
Yes.
And those theories, as we see in the film, there are several theories, and people have their pet theories and are really wondering what the data is going to show them.
Yeah, so let me give you a little background to that. So this machine is kind of a part of a sequence of machines of this nature, beginning back before the Second World War, so back 70, 80 years even, which were tabletop versions of this, the same kind of idea. And we have, the physics community has gradually built bigger and bigger versions of these, and in so doing, done lots and lots of experiments and created a deeper understanding as those experiments were unraveled and analyzed of what the basic forces of nature are. And the grand vision is, first of all, to understand what are the basic forces of nature, and ultimately to ask a question, is there any kind of grand unification of these? Is there some magical, wonderful, what have some physicists have termed theory of everything, that somehow there's some master equation from which everything else follows, include from the beginnings of the universe onwards. So that's the kind of grand vision that people in the field of high-energy physics kind of hold. And what happened prior to the building of this machine is that something that had become known as the standard model of the elementary particles and the fundamental forces had been developed, that it culminated near the end of the 20th century and was really an enormous achievement, but there were some pieces missing. And that's what this film is about, is the kind of the search using the accelerator at CERN and the building of these big detectors and the search for some of the missing pieces. But the vision goes back, if you like, I suppose, even to Newton, or maybe even to our Greek forebears, who had a kind of Platonic ideal that there should be some ideal from which kind of all this messiness that we see around us somehow has followed. But if we only looked at it the right way, we would see some kind of perfection in the world that we've inhabited, and therefore understand a little more deeply man's place in the universe. But Newton, I think, in the modern era, was really the point of departure, because Newton, who invented not just the laws of gravity, the way things attract each other via gravity, but maybe much more deeply at that time, the laws of motion. And in a way, what he discovered was that there were universal laws of motion, so that the laws that govern the motion of objects on the planet, the way we move, the way everything moves, are actually identical to the laws that govern the motion of the planets around the sun or the moon around the earth and so on. And this is profound, not just for physics, but it's profound for kind of man's place in the universe, because, up to then, in a certain sense, there was this kind of philosophy that all things earthly are earthly, and then there's heaven up there, and that's somehow the place of God, and, we don't have much to do with that. And this showed that, in fact, the motions of the planets follow the laws of Newton, and they are sufficiently well developed and understood that when you answer your cell phone, you are just using Newton's laws, in the sense that it's come off some satellite up there, and we know exactly how to control that satellite, where it is, and so on. So that's the first kind of unification, that there's some great unity to the laws of nature.
But then it turns out that Newton's laws don't govern the relationships that are going on at a very, very tiny scale.
So yes, so into the late 19th and into the 20th century, when as physicists tested more shorter and shorter distances and looked at finer and finer granularity, it was recognized that there were some things that seemed to violate Newton's laws. And out of that came the discovery of quantum mechanics that supplants Newton's laws. But again, and it had a slightly different philosophical basis to do with probability and so on. But nevertheless, there were well-defined equations with well-defined predictions, and all of modern physics follows from, has as its basis quantum mechanics, that there are quantum effects and there's this kind of wave-particle duality, Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and all the other things that many people have heard and read about. But, and the other kind of unification that had taken place before then that people can probably more relate to was done in the 19th century by James Clerk Maxwell, who had unified electricity with magnetism. There's electrical phenomena, and then everybody's familiar with magnets, and they look to be quite different. And the various laws governing electrical and magnetic phenomena had gradually been developed in the 19th century, and Maxwell made this extraordinary leap to write down a set of equations that are called Maxwell's equations, which shows that electricity and magnetism are actually just different manifestations of what is really the same forces. And lest you think that that is some abstract intellectual exercise, that was what he discovered when he did that, that it predicted something that has affected every human being on this planet, namely the prediction and understanding of electromagnetic waves, and therefore the very way in which people are listening to this broadcast is, and it's profoundly changed the way life on this planet has developed in terms of standard and quality of living. And by the way, I will add one thing to that. There's a very amusing story that is apocryphal, probably, about Maxwell and the unification, and that was that he had become quite well known, and Queen Victoria wanted to meet him. And when he met Queen Victoria, she said to him, "You know, Mr. Maxwell, I've heard all these wonderful things about you and all this wonderful work that you've done in terms of understanding electricity and magnetism, and it sounds just so marvelous. But tell me, what use is it?" And Maxwell pondered for a moment and said, "Madam, I have absolutely no idea what use my work will be for the future, but one thing I can assure you of, and that is that your ministers will tax it."
Right. And there we have it. But it is interesting, and this film shows that in another way. In fact, there's somebody in the film, Particle Fever, who says during the Q&A with one of the physicists, "Well, what is going to be the economic use of this experimentation that you're doing?" And the physicist says, "Well, we have no idea," and then gives examples like the ones you gave where pure research later on leads to things. And we don't know what it will lead to. What we do know is that chances are it'll lead to something.
Yeah. So I think, you know, fundamentally, of course, physicists and most people involved in the enterprise see it, of course, because of the science. We want to understand the science. We understand these big questions. We want answers to those big questions and understand more deeply the nature of the universe that we're in and indeed, you know, man's relationship to it. And that's part of the intellectual exercise. And indeed, you know, I'm not sure that there's a big question that raises. I mean, this machine costs, I don't know the exact number, but it's of the order of $10 billion. And that's an enormous amount of money. And the question is, you know, how do you justify that? And it's very hard to justify it, frankly, if you just say, well, you know, it's kind of cultural and these are the kind of big questions we should be asking, all of which I strongly believe in. But, you know, then you ask, well, why don't we give $10 billion to artists or to, you know, sculptors and so on? What's so special about this?
Or people who are hungry.
Or people who are hungry, build more hospitals and so on, whatever. Yeah. You know, so this is always a huge issue, and this is a major societal issue. And I would say I won't try to justify why we should be doing this versus anything else, other than I would say one of the fundamental aspects, it seems to me, about human beings in terms of who we are is that we want to understand. And these are some of the deepest and biggest questions, because not only is it about the fundamental forces of nature, but we know that those fundamental forces were at work in the beginnings of the universe. So it has this implication that starts to touch on some very profound questions that we all, you know, at one time or another in our lives are concerned about when we just look up at the heavens, especially here in New Mexico, where we can actually see all
them.
The stars. And you know, you look at those, and even I as a physicist look at them sometimes, and I'm just in awe. And you do have this marvelous feeling, and you wonder, you know, where did it all come from and why? And in some very primal sense, I think this addresses it. But the other aspect to this, given the amount of money, is that one of the things that we have learned by doing huge projects is that there are, as you've already said, have always been spin-offs, and there always will be. And some are as simple, if you like, as just training people to do something extraordinary. It's both inspirational and good training, and I think we've seen tremendous payoffs from that. But, you know, the whole thing of building CERN, which is the organization, CERN, C-E-R-N, which is French for the European Center for Nuclear Research, one of the things in developing these kinds of big experiments and the extraordinary challenges of dealing with the enormous amounts of data that it generates and the integration of the huge teams of scientists. There are several thousand scientists on each experiment. Getting that data across to them, getting communication. One of the extraordinary things that produced was the World Wide Web. That's where the World Wide Web came from, was to address that question. And that has had, I would even argue that if nothing else practical had come from CERN and the LHC, or any of these enterprises, the invention of the World Wide Web has had such an enormously profound consequence, either good or bad, but it has had enormous impact on the way the globe now operates, and it's made people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos and all the rest multi-billionaires. I'm not sure they quite appreciate that, but, you know, it's created an extraordinary different global community, as well as creating enormous amounts of wealth.
And just to be completely clear, it wasn't a result of the experiments being done at CERN or the results of those experiments. It was a result of needing to manage that many people in a big project.
Yes, so it's kind of interesting. It's a totally, I would say, unpredictable kind of serendipitous spin-off.
Yeah.
And the history of big projects, whether it's the Manhattan Project or the Apollo program, Man on the Moon, or whatever, these big projects have typically had these kind of hidden benefits that are very difficult to quantify. People have tried to do it, of course. Personally, of course, that is not how I would justify it. Personally, I would justify it for the extraordinary questions that are being asked. But it is an extremely interesting kind of juxtaposition that it also has had this history of leading to new things.
We're talking to Jeff West about the film Particle Fever. As a non-physicist watching this, first of all, a film like this can't give you 10 years of graduate-level physics. I mean, we're bringing to it whatever we've got. But one of the things that was really interesting to me was one of the physicists in the film was talking about the idea of a multiverse as opposed to a universe, meaning different side-by-side or kind of non-interacting, whatever, universes with different actual physical laws, different laws of nature. And it kind of brought me back to high school when we were learning chemistry and we learned that the first orbital has two electrons and the second one and the third and so on have the numbers that they have. And I remember thinking, well, why? Why does it have to be two?
Yes.
Is there a universe in which it's four or three or one? I mean, how did these things come to be? Is there a kind of absolute truth and beauty to these things and it has to be that way or not?
Yeah, so, you know, I would say the canonical view of physics is there are these physical laws which we try to understand. We try to put them into a mathematical framework that can be quantitative and predictive and do experiments to test them. And in the, you know, this extraordinary vision that maybe if we do that in enough detail and construct enough, if we're clever enough to construct theories, that we can understand pretty much everything around us, including the details of what goes on at the deepest subatomic distances. And that has led to, as I was talking about earlier, to this idea that we do understand an enormous amount. We have something called the Standard Model, which is maybe a great-great-grandchild of these unifications of Maxwell and Newton and so forth, and quantum mechanics involved, and Einstein relativity is involved. So putting all these together in this mix, we predict things. And one of the things that was predicted by that and was needed to understand in order to help unify certain aspects was this so-called Higgs particle. And the great triumph and why this film was made to a large extent was to show what was involved in trying to discover the Higgs, which it has been discovered about a year or so ago, and a Nobel Prize was given, et cetera, et cetera. But this still left and still leaves a lot of questions unanswered. And if one takes at the level at which we're talking that we believe that the universe is rational, the universe from the beginnings of the universe to whatever small distance scale we want to think of, to the earliest possible times we can imagine, is rational and is governed by mathematics, then some people, in order to make that into a rational, consistent theory, that there are no inconsistencies, that depending to some extent on the character of this Higgs particle, for example, that has been discovered, and we still don't know many of its characters, but we do know what its mass is, that depending on that, we may need to understand unification things like other universes, that there are somewhere the out there, so to speak, other universes that are parallel universes to us or different universes, and even, and it's suggested by one of the theoretical physicists that plays a role in this film, that maybe there are universes that have actually evolved different physical laws. That's quite radical. I wouldn't say that most physicists would put that forward as a speculation, but the question is that testable? Is there some way that is testable, even though we can't communicate with those universes? The other thing that also goes along with this, which is very much related to it, is that in order to get a consistent theory, we may need more than the dimensions that we already live in. We live in three spatial dimensions, up, down, and sideways, plus one time dimension, so we consider that four dimensions. But some people have suggested, and the theory pushes us in that direction, that we may need 10 dimensions or 11 dimensions or whatever. And so these are highly speculative, they're very exciting, and I think one of the extraordinary aspects of them is not so much that there are people that are highly imaginative and very clever and come up with this, but more importantly, are there people highly imaginative and clever that they can test it? Can you test it here on Earth? And I think that's an enormous challenge, and I must say, it's kind of amazing how clever people can be to invent experiments or look for signals that will indicate if there are multiverses or if there are new dimensions.
Now, this is something that you've actually been involved with yourself in your career as a scientist.
Indeed. No, in fact, I spent at least the first 30 years of my professional life I was trained in what this field, by the way, it's called high energy physics, the field that deals with the elementary particles and its interactions. And it's called high energy physics because it requires these kinds of machines that demand very high energy particles in order to probe the shortest possible distances. So, yes, I was involved for many years, first of all at Stanford and then at Los Alamos. The earlier years, I ran the theoretical group, the group doing some of these interesting questions of the theory. But then also we had a sizable experimental group. And we also had a group, by the way, that was involved in something called the superconducting supercollider, which some of you may recall was a machine that was proposed in the, roughly speaking, the early 90s. Late 80s, early 90s, there was going to be a machine much bigger than this LHC that's talked about in this film, much bigger. It was going to be built from scratch in Texas. And this film actually does touch upon that at the beginning. It refers back to that machine, and that machine was canned during the Clinton administration, even though already $3 billion had been spent. The fundamental issue that we discussed earlier came up, and that is, how do you justify spending $10 to $15 billion when there are, you know, people in poverty and we need to build more schools and hospitals and et cetera, et cetera? So this is, you know, a big issue, and it was, I think, a serious error was made actually in not building that machine. And I think physicists are fortunate, and humanity, may I say, is fortunate that the machine built at CERN, the LHC, turned out to be so incredibly successful, and it's a great tribute to them in terms of, by the way, creating what is probably the greatest engineering feat that mankind has ever been involved in. It's quite extraordinary.
Well, that's another thing that I wanted to talk to you about. I mean, the results of the experiment and the vicissitudes of theoretical physics that we've been talking about, I mean, you've got this incredible feat of engineering in which thousands of people were participating in building it. And how do you make sure that nothing goes wrong, that one person doesn't screw up somehow?
Yes, well, this is a huge issue. I mean, this machine has to be, you know, everything has to be right. I mean, not just the machine that accelerates and collides the particles, but of course these enormous detectors that detect them, and the multiple programs that not only control the way in which the machine works, but the way what is being detected. By the way, just to give you a sense of the problems to be faced, I don't have these numbers at the tip of my fingertips, but I can tell you that the amount of data produced in some period of time, say in a day, by the LHC, in terms of those collisions, just pure data being produced, is 100 times bigger than all of the data being produced on this planet during a day, doing everything else.
Good heavens.
Now, obviously, we don't have the computing power to look at every event that happens. So therefore, physicists have to be very clever in determining what are we actually going to look for in this humongous amount of data that's being produced. So there's also that question. So you have these kinds of issues that you have to deal with. So this machine has been extraordinary. It did have, as the film articulates, it had a what turned out to be a, on the scale of the whole enterprise, a very simple problem. It turned out to be a problem that was, you know, problem that you would have maybe, I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, you know, with your automobile or something, that a vacuum, a bunch of tubes which carry the beam and some of the helium that helps cool the machine, it goes down to superconducting temperatures. There were leaks, serious leaks, and it meant that, I forget, and it's in the film, but it was therefore, when that happened, it was delayed while the whole thing had to be redone and so on, and make sure that nothing like that would happen again. But by and large, given the extraordinary complexity of this, it's phenomenal how well it's built. And I will contrast it with something, and that is that Boeing is a phenomenal engineering company. It builds the airplanes we fly on, but it builds something that on the scale of this machine is quite simple, an airplane. And it's been trying to build this Dreamliner, the 787. And the problems it has had have been fantastic, actually, given, you know, the scale at which they're doing things relative to that machine at CERN. So there's it's a wonderful accomplishment. And by the way, the other fantastic accomplishment of this enterprise is that CERN, this European Center for Nuclear Research, founded, I may get the date slightly wrong, but in the early 50s, maybe 53. It was founded in order, post-war, post-Second World War, to bring together internationally the countries of Europe to collaborate together rather than each doing it individually, which had been the modus vivendi up to then, to do it together, that working together we can do more and in a certain sense compete with the United States. The United States has always been a kind of goer loner. And that model for CERN has been, I think in almost everybody's estimation, the greatest successful international ongoing collaboration of anything we have seen, including the United Nations. It has been extraordinary. It's now large. It goes well beyond Europe. It contains countries from all over the world. And it contains people working on the same experiments that are Israelis and Palestinians, Turks and Greeks, and so on. It's quite phenomenal. And it really is, you know, there's a kind of certain idealism that science and the search for knowledge and, again, man's place in the universe transcends cultures and ethnicity and gender and so forth.
And that's their common language, really.
And that is the common language, the common language of science and the thirst and search for knowledge.
We're talking to Jeff West about the Large Hadron Collider and the movie Particle Fever. Now, what were the risks or dangers of this experiment?
That's an interesting question. The risks, yes. I don't. Of course, I immediately thought when thinking of the word risk that there'd be some mighty explosion or something. I don't think there was ever any serious physical risk. the major risk. And the major risk was the risk that they'd find nothing. It was unclear when this machine was first proposed, the Large Hadron Collider was first proposed, we had only vague ideas of what might be found and vague ideas of where this mythical Higgs might occur. And there were lots of arguments, and may I say, from the American side, as they were trying to justify the superconducting supercollider, that in fact the Large Hadron Collider simply wasn't in the energy range, you know, it just wasn't big enough that in fact it would see some of the things we were looking for. So this was a big risk for them to take on, and, you know, a certain serendipity and a certain luck, they found something important.
Namely the Higgs particle.
The Higgs particle, which is very important because it plays this very central role in this so-called standard model, this attempt to unify the forces and understand the basic forces of nature, because the role that it plays, in very simplistic terms, is that it's the particle that is seen to, so to speak, give mass to everything, or at least mass to the particles in the theory. And mass, which is something that we're all very conscious of, I mean, it's in this, for the purposes of this discussion, it's it can be identified with weight. I mean, it's the thing that bounds us to our planet that we're very conscious of in our daily lives. Gravity plays an important role in our daily lives, and mass is the fundamental kind of metric of gravity, of gravitational attraction. So this Higgs plays this critical, pivotal role in that, and that was one of the great triumphs, I would say, the enormous triumph of theory, was that in the 60s, this was already predicted as a possibility that in order for the standard model of the elementary particles to have mass, which obviously it had to have, you needed a mechanism that generated it. And this Higgs particle was invented by several researchers, one of whom was Peter Higgs, after whom it's named. And it's a great triumph that, you know, whatever it is, 45 years later or so, nearly 50 years later, it's been discovered. So in a way, it's kind of interesting because it's a, you know, it's a confirmation, actually, of something that many people, I think the majority of the community, knew had to be there in some form or another. And typical of physicists, many physicists who were concerned in terms of risk that maybe it wasn't going to be there, were already thinking of many different kinds of machinations as to why it shouldn't be there, and that the mechanism was actually more sophisticated than the one suggested by these theorists back in the 60s.
Well, that brings up a question about the reality that, I mean, scientists are human beings, full of desire and pride.
Absolutely.
And they want their theory to be proved, and there are many examples throughout the history of science of errors being made because of that kind of, as they say, pride and prejudice. Is there, in this gigantic collaboration among so many different scientists, is there a way to prevent people's desires and prejudices from influencing the science that comes out of it?
That's a very interesting question, and it brings up all kinds of issues. So there's several levels of it. First of all, I think it is true that it's obviously true that all scientists are human beings, which means they have all kinds of desires. They love, they hate, they're Machiavellian, and they're altruistic, and so on. So they have all the usual marvelous qualities of human beings and all the foibles. And some of them do occasionally come to the fore. And here you have an experiment. You know, there's two major detectors at CERN, and there's two major experiments. And each one has several thousand physicists, or scientists, certainly, involved. And each one, you know, has his or her own life. And one of the things this film tries to do a little bit is to show you people that, well, one of them is actually a deputy leader of one of the searches, and the other one is someone that is, you know, a scientist in it, and is a young lady that is obviously very involved and very passionately committed to it. But there is this kind of interesting thing that with several thousand people, each one wanting to have, you know, somehow be part of it, but also to be an individual, it's very different than certainly the kind of image that most of us had of science, and is still true of much of science, but less so than it was when I entered the field, that it was somewhat individualistic, in fact, maybe in large part individualistic, and occasionally there were collaborations. I mean, that was kind of a mode that had evolved, and now we've gone to thousands of people, and you wonder, why do they do it? I mean, you're just this bit doing, you know, helping build one piece of this detector and so on. And this is, it's a very interesting question. But even in this film, I thought it was very interesting because I knew lots of people who either speak in the film or you just see pictures of them. And one I was particularly interested in is a very good friend of mine who was the director of the lab, the director of CERN, who made the decision and had the foresight to build the LHC. And he is not shown in the film. You only see him in an auditorium with a bunch of other people. And that was kind of interesting to me because, you know, he's a well-known physicist. He was knighted. He's Sir Christopher. So he's gotten his little, you know, his reward. But
Didn't he have a bigger role in the film?
Why didn't he have a bigger role in the film? So it brings up a kind of interesting issue, this very issue of, you know, personality and issues of ambition and so forth. And in the film, one of the central characters, so to speak, in the film is a man named Savas Demopoulos, a very well-known theorist at Stanford. And and I kind of respect him for it. He has this extraordinary hubris near the end, basically saying, I want to get a Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
You know, I want it. And he's been interested in things like extra dimensions and so on. And, you know, you realize, of course, there is a human being there, but he also, I genuinely, obviously, would love to be part of the enterprise to understand. So there is this kind of dual character, which I suppose at all levels we all have. We all want to be, you know, get the feedback both from our colleagues and peers, but also from the general public, and be acknowledged and flattered and all the rest. And yet we have to be part of a team that's doing this. And, you know, Newton, in a certain sense, may have said it when he famously remarked, you know, Newton, who was, for my mind, maybe the smartest man that ever lived, I don't know, but, you know, it was an extraordinary human being in terms of his intellect, made the remark, if I have seen further, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants. And mostly we have absolutely no idea who those giants were. You know, he knew them, but we don't. They're forgotten. And there's something about the human condition and who we are as a society. I would venture to say that every person in this film that is interviewed and talks will be completely forgotten in 50 years, maybe even in 5 years. And that's just the way it is.
And that's the way it is of almost everybody who's ever walked on this planet.
Exactly. So I think we just have to accept that, even though there's this extraordinary aspect that driving to varying degrees each individual is the desire for fame and Hollywood.
And it also, I mean, a film like this can make you reflect on, in your own world, which for most of us isn't science, the extent to which you are part of a bigger enterprise and the extent to which you are driven by reward versus just the satisfaction in doing the thing itself and so on.
Yes, well, I think that's true. I strongly subscribe to that, even though I'd be the last person to deny that I don't have my ego involved in it too.
Right. We're talking to Jeff West about the film Particle Fever, and one of the other things that was interesting to me about it was that there are several people in the film who talk about physics in terms of art, One of them says that a good physicist needs an artistic ability to discern what is a good idea, what is a beautiful idea that is worth considering. And as I was watching it and thinking about this gigantic enterprise that the Large Hadron Collider is, that CERN is it a giant art project?
Oh, that's a good question. And in some ways it could be seen that, and if you see the film, there is a certain elegance to just seeing it and so on. But your question reminds me of someone that I knew when I was entering the field. It was a man named Robert Wilson. And Robert Wilson actually worked on the Manhattan Project. He was a young man in the Manhattan Project here at Los Alamos during the war. But he then became a professor at Cornell. He was a very distinguished experimentalist. And he became the director of something called Fermilab, which is the biggest accelerator in the United States. It is not big enough to see a Higgs, and that's why the superconducting supercollider had been proposed. But he was director of the Fermilab when it opened. And he was an extremely interesting man. And one of the reasons he was so interesting, he was an extremely good sculptor. And he sculpted, and he had stuff around Ithaca, for sure, and where Cornell is. And he played a major role when in designing Fermilab, that it should have architectural beauty and art should be displayed everywhere. And that was the nature of the beast. It's a very unusual and very attractive building. And he made that a central piece, that somehow the science being done needs to be thought of also in conjunction with man's desire for beauty and the whole aspect of culture. And by the way, going back to something we discussed earlier, one of the great quotes from Robert Wilson was that when he was first director and he came up to Congress to justify, again, you know, why we're spending all this money, and he was strongly attacked, or at least the project was strongly attacked, and he was asked, you know, Mr. Wilson, Professor Wilson, why are we spending all this money? What is it doing for the defense of the United States? And to paraphrase him, he said, Congressman, I have absolutely no idea what it will do for the defense of the United States, but it makes the United States worth defending. And it was, a very apt remark. It goes back to that what we were talking about earlier. And in that little speech, he talked about the integration of art and science and how important that was, and it's to do with the spirit and the soul of a nation and the spirit and soul of the individuals in a nation.
But also, I mean, at a very deep level, the way some of the people in this film talk about physics, it is an aesthetic system. Mm-hmm. It is a system filled with harmonies and symmetries and...
Absolutely. So at the fundamental level of physics, in writing equations, one of the wonderful aspects of it is often a search for a certain beauty in the mathematics, that the mathematics itself somehow has a certain elegance. You know, it's not just a messy bunch of equations. Now, some problems, by their very nature, are messy bunch of equations, and so be it. But that is somehow part of being a human being, that this, again, kind of Platonic ideal, that at some deep fundamental level, the fabric of the universe has a certain beauty to it, a certain simplicity, and so on. And, of course, that leaves open this enormous question as to where in the hell did all that complexity and the messiness of life that we all participate in, where in the hell did that all come from if the fundamental equations are so beautiful and symmetric and, you know, don't have any of that messiness? And that is actually what the, if you like, I don't like to use this word, but is the mission of the Santa Fe Institute. This institute is founded here in Santa Fe by a bunch of extraordinarily smart, distinguished scientists 25, 30 years ago. Its mission, if you like, was to try to understand what is the nature of the complexity of life, the complexity of all the things that we have around us, from social interactions to the economy to the weather, the fact that it's, I look out the window and it's snowing, where does that come from? How can I predict what's going to be happening tomorrow? The whole questions of global sustainability, all of these questions which don't seem to have quite the elegance and beauty. So where does that come from? And importantly, for some of us anyway, maybe underneath some of that, there's simplicity and elegance and beauty that can help us understand it.
I also can't help but wonder where our own aesthetics come from. And aesthetics, some people say they're universal and some people say they're not. And this is a very long conversation. But there is, for many, a kind of intuitive love, aesthetic love of certain kinds of elegance and simplicity, which you can't help but wonder whether those things are our own intuitions of the underlying beautiful and simple structures that are the building blocks of the world around us and ourselves.
Yes. I'm not really competent to address that. That's a deep question about, it's almost neurological, but it's also cultural. The question, how much is cultural? How much is individual? How much is universal? How much have we inherited from our evolutionary past and so on? I think the thing that draws many of us to theoretical subjects and theoretical physics and mathematics is that it does have a universality. And I would say, with a few caveats, most people recognize that do mathematics what is beautiful and elegant. Not entirely, but mostly we do. I think we do have, there's a certain kind of obviousness to it. And I think part of it, going to your question, is that one of the things that I think has been discovered in the last few hundred years is this extraordinary fact that if there is any language to the universe, part of it is mathematics. And it isn't Latin or Hebrew or Sanskrit or Arabic. Turns out those aren't languages of the universe. They're languages of odd places on the planet, among people who are rather parochial, actually. But somehow this language of mathematics applies not just in, Illinois, but also in Botswana, but amazingly on Jupiter and at the beginning of the universe. And that's kind of amazing. Now, whether it applies also to, some of the tremendous issues that we deal with on a personal level, like love and hate and so on, who in the hell knows?
Jeff West is a professor and former president of the Santa Fe Institute. He has spent much of his career as a high-energy physicist. We've been talking about the film Particle Fever, which will be screening on Tuesday, the 11th of February, at 7 o'clock at the Lenzik Performing Arts Center. It's a collaboration among the Santa Fe Institute, the CCA, and the Lenzik. It's part of the Science on Screen series. And filmmaker Mark Levinson will be there as well. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. A pleasure, as always.